what's going on with Steve Witkoff? What does he want from Vladimir Putin, in your opinion?
I don't know. First of all, you know, these Steve Witkoff is Trump's personal envoy of choice, right? He has been sent to deal with things with the Israel-Palestine issue. I have heard that he has been sent to Oman to deal with the U.S.-Iranian talks mediated by Oman. He
Which is
has,
tomorrow.
Yes, yes, tomorrow. He has been negotiating with Russia as Trump's go-to when the U.S. and the Russians met for the first time, and it was 3-on-3, and you know, the idea of equivalent ranked members on each side. So we had U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Although, frankly, comparing Mark Rubio as a diplomat versus Lavrov is not a fair comparison. He's a political hack, and Lavrov is the most experienced and formidable diplomat in the world of this generation. And probably, I think you have to go back to figures like Molotov and Bismarck to find his equal anywhere. But there was also Mike Waltz as U.S. National Security Advisor, and Yuri Ushakov, whom is Putin's personal foreign policy advisor. So roughly, you know, equivalent there. And then Trump sent his personal envoy, Steve Witkoff, right? And he is the one who has actually been talking to the Russians the most on other occasions as well. And who is Steve Witkoff? So, you know, he's a storied diplomat. He's been at the State Department for decades. No, he hasn't. No, he's got no diplomatic experience whatsoever. He's got no education in anything of the sort, international relations, nothing. He's got nothing. He is a New York real estate developer friend of Trump. Trump trusts him. That's it. I mean, I've heard people describe him as charming, as I don't know. He seems like a used car salesman, frankly, to me. Right? He's kind of slimy, you know. I don't know. But so you have to weigh these things here. With Trump's choice of him, he's got no experience, right, dealing with the most crucial issue of our times, right? Because the conflict in Ukraine has become a global order changing conflict, right? Out the other side of it, you know, in the middle of it, yes, but even more so out whatever the end game of it indeed looks like. And you know, the U.S. has got someone with no experience, no real knowledge of Russia. A couple of weeks ago, he couldn't even remember what the Donetsk and Luhansk Republic names were, and Kherson and Zaporozhye and Crimea. There's a few of them, right? You know, little details, right? And, you know, of course, one of Russia's demands is that those five regions at a minimum are all now part of Russia. So you think that the top negotiator would, you know, might have a handle of this, but, you know, details, schmeetails, right? You know, Trump doesn't need any of that. He can make a deal. The art of the deal. It's high diplomacy, geopolitics, New York real estate, you know, mafia tactics. It's the same thing, right? You know, okay. But on the other hand, now, obviously, I've been expressing nothing but contempt for Steve Witkoff in that regard, but there is something to be said for this choice. Trump doesn't trust anyone within the U.S. blob, as Ben Rhodes called it, the foreign policy and security elite in and out of office, right? The deep state, the permanent bureaucracy, whatever you want to call it. Trump's at war with these people, right? And a political war internal in the U.S. And particularly after his first administration, he doesn't trust any of them, right? Does he really trust Marco Rubio? No, probably not, right? You know, it's Witkoff, right? Witkoff is the guy he keeps shuttling back and forth. And Russia's equivalent choice, all right, who Putin selected interestingly as the equivalent of Witkoff is Kirill Dmitriev. Kirill Dmitriev is the head of Russia's direct investment fund, right? It's not a government position. It's actually a civilian business role, right? You know, an administrative business role. It's not the same as the American Chamber of Commerce, but as you could think of him as the chair of that fund in a similar way. And he's U.S. educated. Yeah, he received some higher, not completely, but he received some higher education in the United States. He speaks fluent English. As people who saw him, he was just in the White House over a week ago. And they went on U.S. media afterwards, where they asked him about, you know, the possibility of Russia, giving concessions in Ukraine in return for sanctions relief. And he was like, he shattered their brains. Right. He said, nope, not really. It's not a priority for us. Our economy is doing fine, growing at 4% GDP last year. Better than you, better than the Europeans. Right. A lot of Russian businesses have done very well after the Americans and Europeans left the market. Right. We are now the most sovereign major power in the world, probably the most sovereign country in the world. Right. You can't hold us hostage and blackmail us again with your sanctions, with your control of SWIFT and the global financial architecture. You know, if you want to, you know, you want to come back into our market, that's a favor for you. We can discuss that, right? But it's not a priority for us. We have goals of the SMO. That's our priority. And that kind of shocked them, right? Because that's not what the way the Western media presents it. But that was, you know, I think the first time that the American public really saw Kirill Dmitriev. Interestingly enough, Kirill Dmitriev was actually born in Ukraine, right? He was born in Kiev, and Zelensky has declared him a traitor separatist and ordered his arrest because, you know, never mind the fact that he's a Russian citizen now. Now he was born in Ukraine and now he's a traitor, and so he must be dealt with because the regime that Zelensky leads, you know, the Maidan regime, has assassinated, murdered thousands of East Ukrainians, right? Of Ukrainians who didn't agree with the 2014 U.S.-backed Maidan putsch and everything that has happened since, right? Militia leaders, politicians, activists, you know, administrators, anyone, right? I mean, they've killed hundreds. It's got to be up into the thousands. And then they're quite proud about it. It was openly admitted by Budanov and others, right? You know, Ukrainian military intelligence was rebuilt from the ground up by the CIA, effectively as an assassination machine, right? To kill dissidents, Ukrainian dissidents. Now, Kirill's not a dissident. You know, he's long since become a Russian, but that doesn't stop Zelensky from regarding him as a traitor. And he's not the only one. Alexei Zabritsky is currently one of the Russian cosmonauts on the International Space Station, right? But Zabritsky, young guy, you know, for the role, very accomplished. He was born in Zaporozhye, and he went to a military academy and became a pilot in Kharkov, and then served in the Ukrainian military as a pilot. Well, when 2014 happened and Crimea had the referendum to return to Russia, the majority of the Ukrainian Navy and Air Force, right, they defected to Russia, right? Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, even had, I'm sure it's out there somewhere still, a video report on it, where they admitted that 75% of the Ukrainian Navy defected to Russia, right? And he was one of them, right? And he was good as a pilot, and he earned trust, and he made accomplishments, and he was selected for cosmonaut training, and he was selected to actually be sent into space. And Zelensky regards him as a traitor and a deserter, right? Obviously, he should be, you know, conscripted and sent to the front in the trenches like everyone else, right? And he has ordered his arrest, right? So obviously, you know, the Ukrainians are going to, you know, I don't know, jet up to the International Space Station and put Zabritsky in handcuffs any day now. It's madness. The man is mad. He hates Russians. He admitted it. And these people self-identify as Russians. And Lavrov pointed out today, how can we let this man govern any ethnic Russians or pro-Russians or Russian speakers in Ukraine? He said that he has hatred for them and that it fuels him, despite the fact that he, of course, is a native Russian speaker himself, right? He speaks Ukrainian, you know, not very well. It's not his mother tongue. He made his comedic fortune in the Russian language. You can't even show his movies without, you know, having them dubbed over in Ukraine today. But, you know, that is who Zelensky is. Zabritsky, Dmitriev, they fall in the same category. Dmitriev, again, is the equivalent of Witkoff, someone that Putin trusts but is seen as a business person who can speak the language of Witkoff and Trump. And now Witkoff is in Moscow, and it's not hard to guess that, you know, he is being sent to try to jumpstart relations, right? There was just another meeting in Istanbul at a diplomatic technical level that is going through the arduous process of correctly restoring diplomatic function between the two countries that were down to skeleton crews and harassment of, you know, of the diplomats and everything. And they're negotiating things like Russia is demanding the diplomatic territory that was, you know, according to, you know, the Russian point of view, illegally seized under international law by the United States, by the then Obama administration. There's also a question of banking, like simply for the diplomats to be able to, you know, have an account and buy things and so forth. And the Americans, for they want the right to hire Russians citizens to work at the Russian at the U.S. embassy in Moscow again. These are, you know, boring things for most people, right? I mean, that's not what you're tuning in to hear about the conflict and geopolitics. And U.S. and Russia right now are haggling over banking rights for diplomatic, units and hiring locals to do embassy functions and things like that. I mean, that's what's going on. And as far as any peace settlement goes, right, that's dead. I mean, the first ceasefire, quote unquote, the electrical energy infrastructure, the Kiev regime is essentially violating it, if not every day, then every other day. And I think I saw a headline today that they violated it 5 times the day before, right? So obviously that's, you know, Russia is still going through the motions, I guess, with the intent of pleasing Trump and or proving to him that, yeah, we're serious about this ceasefire. But the reality is, of course, is that Russia doesn't need to hit the Kiev regime's energy infrastructure. It usually launches its missile salvos with like a month in between them, right? When it does assessment and finds out, you know, what it heat needs, what they are able to repair, what they're not, what are they able need to hit next. So 30 days, you know, they can finish that up. You know, and then point out that it's the Kiev regime who doesn't want peace. The reality is that no one wants peace except for the United States, right, at this moment, right? And they want peace to save a U.S. proxy regime in Kiev. That's why they want peace, because they lost this war. The U.S., NATO, the Kiev regime proxies lost this war against Russia, or if not lost it, are well on the way to losing it. Right. With no real hope of altering that capability, unless some type of deal is cut, right? Some peace settlement to save it. That's why Russia, the Kiev regime, Europe, you know, they all want peace, but only on their own terms, right? If it's not their terms, they have no interest in peace. And so the Black Sea Initiative, the grain deal 3.0, right? What Russia asked for is, okay, when there was an original grain deal, we were promised a degree of concessions from the West, things like reconnecting Russia's agricultural bank to SWIFT, making it possible to get maritime insurance for its ships, because, well, you know, if the issue is getting grain to the world, especially the developing world, yeah, Ukraine is was the fifth biggest exporter of grain in the world, you know, when this all started. Russia's number one, right? They have a lot more grain, right? A lot more. They're also number one in fertilizer, by the way, and these other things. And they're like, you know, if this is supposedly out of humanitarian concern for the world food markets, we're all on board that, but yeah, we're a much bigger part of that than Ukraine. So you need to stop your, you know, all your sanctions instruments that inhibit us from getting our grain and fertilizer to global markets that need it, our agricultural products. And the West, of course, never fulfilled those agreements, right? Once again, you know, they broke the terms of a deal brokered with Russia and laughed all the way to the bank, right? Now the Europeans are refusing to meet any of these conditions, right? And the SWIFT banking system is in Belgium, and Europe has considerable say along with the US and what happens there. And the question of maritime insurance, that's mostly out of London, right? You know, that they still run the majority. Now, Russia and India and other countries have been getting into it now, but it would make it much easier to be done via the big established insurance giants in the field that are more, say, reputable or have a degree of trust, you know, long-term business. And so, you know, the UK said no, right? And the same issue with ports and the like. So that's also dead in the water. The Europeans are stymied that. And right now, there is no scheduled meeting that I'm aware of, that I don't think anyone's reported on, between Russia and the U.S., between officials of Russia and the U.S. to discuss the conflict in Ukraine. They're not doing that, right? Russia and the U.S. are working on improving bilateral relations. That's what this meeting in Istanbul, a second meeting on the issue of diplomatic work, restoring basic diplomatic functions. That's what that's about. And Russia is considering these two tracks, right? On one hand, it's bilaterally improving relations with the U.S. as much as is possible, taking this window of opportunity with the Trump administration, right? And on the other hand is a diplomatic settlement of the conflict in Ukraine, right? And as far as Russia's concerned, there should only be limited overlap between those two issues. And if this one doesn't work out, well, we should still try to improve relations otherwise, because there's a whole bunch of other things, crises in the world that Russia and the U.S. should and really need to talk to each other about, like the U.S. threats of bombing Iran, right? Unless Iran agrees to a deal with the man who ripped up the last deal that Iran had with a nuclear deal with the United States, right? The JCPOA. So, you know, Russia, you know, can serve as an intermediary in that regard. They are a new improved strategic partner of Iran. So Russia is making the condition. And I think to, you know, to talk about what Witkoff is doing here, right, with the bilateral relations bogged down in the minutiae of restoring basic diplomatic functions, right, and the peace, the ceasefires, the peace, you know, settlement going nowhere, and the Russians increasingly saying, well, look, you're not even talking about the root causes of the conflict. We're not interested in a general ceasefire, right? That doesn't, you know, do proper work in that, you know, at least towards that, right? And we're not, you're not even talking about that. So I think Russians see that this, the lack of experience or lack also, I would have to say, of a unified position within the Trump administration on the issue of the conflict in Ukraine leaves the thing, it's dead in the water right now. And I think Witkoff is making some personal appeal to Putin. He's meeting Putin personally. And, you know, that's something, because who is Witkoff? He's the New York real estate developer, right? He's not a diplomat. He's not a minister. He's not a president. He's Trump's gopher, right? His trusted personal envoy that is getting to meet the Russian president again, according to some reports. And I think that you know, Trump is increasingly getting desperate. It doesn't seem that everything he's doing is working out so well. His global war of tariffs on the world, he's walking it back now, except for on China, after not just the U.S. Stock market, but I think perhaps more importantly, the bond market tanked, right? The value of the dollar fell, everything. And now he's like, yeah, I'm going to give you a 90-day extension on that, right? 90 days. And they could extend that even further than 90 days, except for China. Because China. And China resisted us and replied tariffs back tit for tat. And that really made Trump angry, because, you know, the other superpower in the world was just supposed to bow down. And to use Trump's words to describe how the leaders of most of the world were coming to him to, quote unquote, kiss my ass and promise me anything, sir. Please remove these sanctions. That is the contemptuous way that the president of the United States spoke about the leader of nearly every other country in the world. That's not going so well. You know, his threats to bomb Iran. Yeah, Iran is talking now, but I really doubt that they're going to get what they want from Iran, right? Because while nominally what people are talking about is they want, Iran doesn't have an active nuclear weapons program, right? They enrich uranium. They have a nuclear domestic industry, which is their right under international law, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as a non-nuclear country. But the U.S. and Israel, you know, are now saying, you can't have any nuclear enrichment whatsoever, right? You're because you're Iran and we don't like you. And that would supposedly prevent breakout. But I think also that what the Trump administration wants is it wants to demand that Iran stops any relationship, any support for the Ar Ansala movement in Yemen, for the Houthis, for Hezbollah in Lebanon, for Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq and Syria. They want them to knock everything off, right? And of course, they want Iran to drop the axis of resistance, right? You know, their support for Shias, you know, throughout the Middle East. And Iran, of course, is not going to do that. So that also leaves those negotiations in jeopardy, shall we say, in a point of tension. And well, I have to say that my gut, reading Trump is hard, right? And God knows I've been wrong about Trump, about some specific things in the last few months. So I think overall, I wouldn't say that I've been terribly off the mark, just at various points along the line. But it is difficult. But I think he's bluffing. I think he's bluffing. I don't think he wants a war in the Middle East, right? I don't think the U.S. has enough air defense missiles now to fight Iran, right? With Iran able, with a significant missile and drone capability that they have demonstrated, that can reach out and hit every U.S. military base, the hundreds of them, you know, in the Middle East and in the area. Israel and so forth, and I don't think the U.S. can defend them, right? They certainly can't defend Israel from a concentrated. And you know, Iran has their own nuclear option of mining or otherwise blocking traffic through the Persian Gulf, which would, you know, tank the world. Well, not tank, but raise oil prices, you know, through the roof, right? Because so much of the daily oil trade in the world goes through the Persian Gulf. So I don't think Trump really wants that. Trump seems pretty focused. If you check, you know, this supposedly leaked U.S. threat assessment and everything, they want to be laser focused on China. Right. That's what they see as the threat. They want the stuff in Ukraine to go away, but they can't seem to come up with an actual way to save face and U.S. interests and get out of that. Right. They want Iran to just quiet down in the Middle East so that they can then deal with China. Right. That's what they want to focus on. But that's what every U.S. president has wanted since Obama. Since his pivot to Asia, and every one of them gets bogged down in the Middle East and with Russia and everything else. And then that military pivot to confront China never quite happens. Right. And if the U.S. began air and missile strikes on Iran, that any potential war with China in the Taiwanese Straits and the South China Sea that the U.S. might seek to provoke there, China just got a 5 or 10 more years to prepare, because the U.S., you know, would exhaust. I think they're already, we already know how short they are. Again, particularly this Achilles heel of a shortage of air defense missiles. And that for a system that the Patriot, that I think has serious questions as to its actual effectiveness, as demonstrated in Ukraine as well. So I think Trump, he's flailing domestically right now, with you know, the so much upheaval coming as a result of the tariffs, walking back some tariffs. But you know, U.S. consumers are going to feel the bite just of this 10% across the board tariffs, and the, I don't know, the 5 billion percent, what is it, 125 now or 145 against China. Amazon's CEO just put out a warning. 70% of Amazon's goods are sourced from China.
Wow.
70%. So obviously the U.S. consumer is going to be feeling the bite very soon, right? And, you know, Trump's got to win midterm elections. If he doesn't win midterm elections, then, you know, he won't be able to get much done for the next, you know, the remaining 2 years of his administration. He'll probably be fighting another impeachment, right? No, because that's the lawfare, the way the U.S. works now. So he's got to find some way to salvage the domestic situation. He wants to pivot to China. But now he's looking at a trade war with China developing. And it's quite seems pretty clear that what he really wanted was China to just bow down and cut a deal with him on his terms. And I don't know why he thought that the Chinese would do that. But the man is, you know, I don't think Hubris is his literal middle name, but, you know, it really should be. He is a self-aggrandizing, narcissistic megalomaniac, you know, and that's being nice. He's just got a lot of problems, and it would be nice if he could get some type of progress on this Ukraine thing, right? And all the time, Russia's like, hard diplomatic work ahead, months and months, small steps, right? You know, and he's getting frustrated. He thought he was going to have a handshake and a deal and the war would be over and a U.S. proxy regime saved and Putin would be happy just to be invited back to the club, you know, and that's...
Mark, let me read what he has tweeted, what he has put on his social media. It says, Russia has to get moving. Too many people are dying, thousands a week in a terrible and senseless war. To which direction he wants to move Russia? He wants Russia to move. And what is that direction in the mind of the Trump administration and Trump himself?
Yeah. He wants a ceasefire. He wants a period where the guns stop so that the West can rearm and resupply and you know, they can continue to mobilize and save the Kiev regime. That's what he wants. Oh, the people are dying. Yeah, the people are dying in Yemen, too, because you're bombing them, right? And you're threatening to bomb Iran. Don't give me this bleeding heart. Don't pretend that Trump is some type of humanitarian. That's just sick. Right. We're talking about the guy who assassinated Qasem Soleimani in Iraq with a number of top Iraqi generals, by the way, as well. Right. This Trump is a peacemaker is just absolute pabulum. Right. I mean, you really have to be a Trump fanboy, mindless drone to take any of that seriously. But that's what he wants. Right. He wants a deal that will, you know, maybe frozen conflict, you know, a ceasefire leading to a frozen conflict to give time for the situation to change and for him to focus on other things because he doesn't want to deal with this. And, you know, Russia's not interested in that. Russia's been very specific. They're not interested. They want a final settlement that meets all the terms of the SMO and solves the what they regard as the core causes of the conflict before the guns stop, right? And Trump wants the opposite. So they're kind of at loggerheads. And Russia is preparing to launch major offensives in the next month or two, right? We're going to see huge numbers of new troops. The Kiev regime says that Russia has 150,000 troops and 15 divisions, right? Trained up, equipped, not yet part of the SMO, but waiting, right? I think it's very likely that they will be injected. The Ukrainians, Kiev regime certainly thinks so. The question is where? Zaporozhye, Sumy region, you know, somewhere else, right? You know, these are all possibilities. And a lot of it depends on where the Kiev regime shuffles what troops it has left around the battlefield and so forth. But Russia is, yeah, we'll talk, but we're going to continue fighting, right? You know, they don't buy, you know, the Trump is insisting, oh, but in order for any diplomatic work to happen, there has to be a ceasefire. No, that's not true at all. I mean, it wasn't true when you negotiated a deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan. It wasn't true in Vietnam or Korea for the United States either. Negotiations in Vietnam went on for years while fighting went on. So no, that's not true. We're not going to give you, you know, we've been down this road before. Minsk 1, Minsk 2, you just, you know, retrain and rearm and come back again. That's not going to happen this time. And the Europeans, the at least the British and the French, are threatening that as soon as there is a ceasefire, they're going to put their troops, i.e. NATO troops, on the ground in Ukraine, right? Russia's, and I think part of that calculation is, of course, saying that, well, they know that Russia would never accept that, and they want to prevent any ceasefire from happening. That's why they're so loudly talking about this, even as British generals, British brass, speaking to the Telegraph on condition of anonymity, said that this is political theater, and they have no ability to send troops that could deal with Russia on the ground in Ukraine, right? I mean, at best, human tripwire, but even then, there's a question about their ability to even sustain a human tripwire deployment in Ukraine. That's how bad the British and French militaries really are. I mean, you can call them paper tigers, but that's not right, because even on paper, they look like, I don't know, decrepit Yorkies or something, right? Like some kind of disabled Yorkie. I don't know. So, you know, Trump is desperate. He wants some type of deal, but Russia's in the driver's seat, right? You know, he's himself has at times admitted that Russia has all the cards. And they're not interested in helping Trump save face or pivot to deal with other issues domestically or elsewhere that he would rather deal with. So Russia is, yeah, we'll talk, but in the meantime, until we get what we want, we're just going to continue on the battlefield. And Putin spoke to a group of sailors in Murmansk a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about, we think it is possible, right? There's a probable chance that we could finish the Kiev regime forces off this year, right? Those were, that was very specific language that he was using, right? So, you know, that of course leaves Trump in a bind. What does he do, right? Does he escalate to de-escalate? How does he do that, right? More sanctions? You could go from 18,000 and some to 19,000 and some. Russia's, you know, not really, it's all pointless at this point, right? All sanctions are now is sanctioning the rest of the world, right? Secondary sanctions to try to force them to stop trading with Russia. It hasn't worked out so well. It's not that countries defy it. It's just they work around it, right? Loopholes are always found. Loopholes are always made, whether we're talking India or China or, you know, the global South, whoever, even the Greek oil industry, you know, the shipping, they find ways of that ships run into each other in the middle of the night and some oil is just transferred from one ship to the other, and that sort of things happen. So, and militarily, I mean, what else does the U.S. have that the assessment from the Director of National Intelligence, the group assessment of U.S. intelligence across the board, came to the conclusion that there is no current or future weapons package that the U.S. could deliver to Ukraine that would change the fact that Russia has the advantage, a severe advantage on the battlefield. That was admitted, you know, by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence just a few weeks ago. So, I mean, the Trump administration is aware of that. They can make things tougher. They can drag things out. They can make it bloodier. But at the end of the day, they're not going to change that reality. The reality of a war of attrition where Russia's military industrial complex is geared up and outperforming the entirety of the West, the entirety of NATO, by, as Mark Rutte has pointed out, by more than three times. The Russian troops are motivated, right? Sirsky just admitted today that the size of the Russian military is growing, right? Every month, by several thousand troops. Right. I mean, that's net, you know, losses and new troops coming in, and they're growing by several thousand troops every month. And you know, of course, you know, he's lamenting that they can't really keep up with that. So, you know, I don't think that there's really, I think that both sides, particularly the Trump administration, will go through the motions of continuing, you know, talks about ceasefires, about peace settlement and everything. But at the end of the day, Putin is very politely saying, "Niet," is saying no to Trump. And Trump would like to walk away, but he's simply no U.S. president, not even him. No matter how much contempt he has for Zelensky, no matter how much contempt he has for Europe's leadership, right? No matter how much he doesn't care about Ukraine in the big scope of things, he's still the U.S. president and he can't accept Russia's terms, right? The Kiev regime is a U.S. proxy state and he has to find some way. I'm sure that it's that some part of him would like to walk away, wash his hands, say this is Biden's mess, but he hasn't given any real indication that he has that political will, that he would be willing to expend the necessary amount of domestic political capital to do that. So then, you know, that leaves him in a bind and the conflict goes on and it will go on, you know, for some time, even without the U.S. Sending new weapons packages, right? The U.S. is still sending arms to Ukraine every month, right? Because a great deal of these arms packages that Biden sent were not just for things off the Pentagon's shelves, but long-term contracts with the U.S. military industrial complex that, as it's produced monthly, it gets sent over to Ukraine. You know, whether we're talking ammunition, vehicles, drones, you know, whatever, that's ongoing. And the Europeans are talking about accelerating things. I don't know whether we can, but Germany just promised another multi-billion-dollar military package to Ukraine in the last 24 hours. Now, if you read the details of that, that is through 2029, right? And I don't know if there is going to be a Ukraine left in 2029, to be perfectly honest, right? But they're still have the intention of sending, of keeping, trying to make up for the U.S. if the U.S. doesn't deliver any new aid packages. Again, it could make things longer, make things bloodier, more costly for Russia. But, you know, unless they get a black swan, then, you know, which is essentially, I guess, what they're hoping for. One thing I wanted to bring up back on the issue of tariffs and this mafia style way of dictating, forcing negotiations to, right? Trump has figured out that the neoliberal globalization that the U.S., the system that the U.S. built globally over decades, right? Free trade system doesn't work for U.S. interests anymore. I mean, that's been known for quite some time. Capital flows moving from west to east. U.S. companies, you know, running to Asia and source of cheaper labor, you know, so forth and so on. The collapse of U.S. manufacturing and industries being laid perfectly clear in this conflict and their inability to jumpstart their military industrial complex to meet this challenge. The U.S., you know, is just demanding that the rest of the world renegotiate the terms of global trade to benefit the U.S. now. All right. And it's a mafia, you want to call it madman theory, you know, where Trump says plays mad and everyone will, according to him, come running and kiss his ass. He has reached the conclusion that U.S. hegemony, right, is too expensive, right? And what's one of the most interesting details about that is it's emerging that the thought inside the Trump White House, inside the Trump admin, is not that the U.S. should therefore give up the pursuit of hegemony and primacy. It's that the rest of the world should pay for it and be glad to pay for it, right? And this was put out by Mirren, whom is Trump's, the chairman of Trump's, the Council of SEPA, Economic Policy Advisors, right? And he spoke this week in defense of the tariffs and about the tariffs. And he said that they were to collect money, right, to read this renegotiation of global trade on U.S. terms is to pay for U.S. global public goods, right? That the rest of the world should help burden, pay the burden sharing cost of. And what they identified is, number one, the U.S. military, its network of hundreds of military bases around the world, you know, the ones that they send into countries willy-nilly, you know, whenever they feel like it. That's a global public good, and the rest of the world should pay for their military overmasters, right? And the second was the use of the dollar as the global reserve currency. That's expensive. That requires the U.S. to run trade deficits and the like, and that's too expensive, right? And you should pay, the rest of the world should pay the U.S. for the privilege of using the dollar, right? That's, now, never mind that Trump himself has threatened to destroy BRICS if they dare to even think about creating an alternative currency, and everyone has to have the dollar force. That contradiction, of course, never really occurs to them. And the fact that they can run $37 trillion national deficits and onto the moon because the dollar is, you know, the currency of global trade still for, well, not for Russia anymore, but for much of the rest of the world. You should pay for that privilege. That's what they're saying. That's what the tariffs are for. The tariffs are so that the U.S. can continue in the role as hegemon and in the pursuit of primacy, but the rest of the world should pay for it. That is so much hubris. So it just boggles the mind, right? That they think it is one thing, but that they come out and say it openly is, I know some people had hope that the Trump administration would represent some kind of break with the past. And there's been some break in methodology, right? But ultimately, again, the U.S. doesn't, the Trump administration doesn't even intend to abandon hegemony. They just want to force the rest of the world to pay for it. So, as far as I'm concerned, battle lines are drawn. Now the Chinese are stepping up to the plate as well.